You're listening to FMGRadio.com. Welcome to Generation Reinvention, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Future, with your host, Brent Green.
Welcome back to Generation Reinvention. I recently conducted two workshops in Colorado Springs for the Chamber of Commerce and a unique day-long conference called the Business of Aging Summit. Colorado Springs community leaders are embracing the aging of the boomer generation as an opportunity, and many living there are intent upon making this community one of the nation's best for retirement and aging. I'm honored today to have another workshop presenter as my guest. She is a much-respected university educator and expert on geropsychology. Dr. Sarah Hahn Qualls is Professor of Psychology and Aging Studies and Director of the Gerontology Center at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, which we'll often refer to as UCCS during this program. She led the development of the doctoral program in clinical psychology that emphasizes geropsychology. We'll talk about geropsychology and its implications for you as a caregiver or for yourself as you age. She also helped found the CU Center, Aging Center, where students learn to provide mental health and family interventions for older adults. Dr. Qualls founded a unique collaboration between UCCS and the Palisades at Broadmoor Park, a privately owned senior residential community where faculty and students create cutting-edge wellness programs using some very innovative technologies. We're going to discuss this remarkable intersection between private enterprise and academia. As a clinician, Dr. Qualls developed caregiver family therapy that integrates existing empirically based interventions with family therapy principles. How does aging impact family dynamics? What are the pitfalls? What are the opportunities for better collaboration between siblings? She has served in leadership roles with the American Psychological Association, including chairing the Committee on Aging and serving on the Presidential Task Force on Caregiving. Dr. Qualls has published several books on geropsychology, including Aging and Mental Health. Her most recent book on caregiver family therapy is at the publisher. Her research currently involves studying family caregiver therapy intervention, technology interventions designed to produce pro-social behavior in older adults and families, and senior housing wellness models. As you can tell, we have much to talk about and much to learn. So I'd like to welcome Sarah Qualls to the program.
Thank you, Brent. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm very pleased to have you join the show. And I'd like to begin today very much at a basic level, probably for my benefit and certainly for some of our guests listening. Let's ask a basic question. What is gerontology and why do we need it?
Gerontology is the study of and application of science, really, to aging. So it is inherently multidisciplinary. Many disciplines contribute to it. And really, the term gerontology essentially refers to all aspects of aging outside a strictly medical context, which usually is referred to as geriatrics.
Okay. It's a field that began when? When did it become a formal discipline and then evolve very rapidly to become a university curriculum and so forth?
It really was launched in the late 50s by a group of visionaries who all came out of their own disciplines, and by 1960 had founded the Gerontological Society of America, which is the premier scientific multidisciplinary organization, and two core journals that have gone on to have continued to be the primary dissemination mechanisms for scientists to communicate with each other, the Journals of Gerontology and the Gerontologist.
Okay, so it's a field that probably owes its beginning mid-20th century, and it's multidisciplinary. And you now have programs at UCCS in several areas, And I'm curious about the students themselves. What are their goals? Why do they choose to enter the field of gerontology? I'm sure there's differences among individuals, but what are some of the generalities?
I think the common variable probably, honestly, is that they've had a great experience with an older adult in their individual lives. Almost every single one of our students who applies in nursing or psychology or any of the other disciplines has a story to tell about a very powerful person in their life. So then they find themselves intellectually or practically intrigued in one domain or another, whether, you know, not, someone could be an architect, not on our campus, but, you know, an architect or a healthcare provider or a policymaker. And because of this profound experience they had personally, they get it more quickly than others that we are an aging society that has not even hardly scratched the surface of addressing the practical problems that we and possibilities that an aging society brings. So it's a mixture of factors, but it has been intriguing to me how important a family experience usually is.
I am also curious, do they sometimes envision maybe, say, the economic opportunities that might occur with such a rapid and large aging of the Western world populations? Is this seen as a career opportunity for the future among some of them?
I think it is. And I think in the field of business or engineering, for example, I think students are looking at the potential for the need for business development that might reward them economically. In other areas of healthcare services, there's a sense of job security. And I think in many of those disciplines, there's an awareness that aging services are undervalued and often won't receive the top pay. And so people have to have a mix of motives, I think. They have to have a personally compelling reason for investing their life in solving a problem, a set of problems that society doesn't want to look at as directly.
Okay. Well, at UCCS, you are co-founder of the CU Aging Center. So, of course, I'd love to know what the center is, what does it do, who does it help, and what has it accomplished?
Well, the CU Aging Center was launched to be a training clinic, essentially, for the doctoral program in geropsychology that we were launching at that time. And this was in the late 1990s. When we opened the doors of the center, we didn't know exactly what direction it was going to take. We knew we needed a training facility, and we knew the community needed help in the broad area of mental health services. What has evolved over time is, of course, something none of us ever would have pictured. First of all, I want to comment on the name. You notice the word mental health isn't in it, and that was based on some excellent advice from colleagues. To avoid the potential stigma of the term mental health. But the door that opened for us was then to think more broadly. So when we started to think about, well, how do you support the mental health of older adults, you can think in a bunch of directions. So we certainly do provide traditional mental health services, psychotherapy, assessment. We also provide assessment of cognitive functioning, which is a cognitive decline is a correlate of later life, especially cognitive decline caused by illnesses, which we'll probably talk about later. But cognitive assessment plays a particularly important role in providing mental health services to older adults that is quite different from other age groups where you just don't need to have that set of skills. We also developed an aging family and caregiver program based on our recognition that families often were floundering to find a direction to support their loved ones. And they didn't always know they were caregivers when they floundered around looking for help. Sometimes they didn't think of themselves as caregivers at all. They were just families doing what families do, but really struggling to plug in what was needed and to meet the needs of the older adults in their lives while maintaining the rest of their life. The pathway that's been kind of unusual for our center is that we have ended up in very deep, rich collaborations, creating pretty innovative approaches to integrated care. we certainly do more what's becoming the sort of more traditional approach of integrating mental health into primary care. We also, however, integrate it into settings that people often don't think about, from the police department to senior housing to legal services and probate court. All of these are service delivery systems for older adults whose delivery process is affected by mental health, and they often haven't had on their team a mental health provider who could really help them assess and conceptualize the problems they were seeing. And so we've looked for opportunities to partner with people who were already serving older adults in the ways that the older adults wanted to access it, and then add mental health into an existing service stream.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm wondering, having been a caregiver for my own parents for about 8 years, what are some of the factors that shape family responses to the aging process? What do people bring to the CU Aging Center with them, maybe typical? What are the problems?
Well, like at all other stages of the family life cycle, we tend not to look ahead as a family. So we tend to want information and understanding on a need-to-know basis. When our children reach adolescence, we suddenly pay attention to adolescence. The same thing's true about aging. The difference about aging for families is there are several differences that are really interesting. One of them is that older adults' health crises tend to be fairly acute and urgent, and families often get pulled in to provide support under time-sensitive conditions that generate a good bit of anxiety for the family. They've got to make a decision today about a problem they might not have known existed until yesterday.
Oh, yes.
And that, and if therefore, if you need to make those decisions urgently, you either need to come to that moment with a really well-defined, well-functioning decision-making structure, or you're going to find yourself in quite a bit of anxiety and ambiguity, which is the condition for most families. So families come to this urgent moment. There's a lot of anxiety with it. They're faced with figuring out how to navigate a service system they have no experience with, and their family structure really isn't prepared for this kind of decision-making. Most siblings and especially siblings, adult children, since they left home, they may have never made a decision together more serious than how they're going to structure the potluck at the next holiday. And suddenly here they are drawn together to make potentially life and death or quality of life decisions under urgent and anxiety-provoking circumstances with no decision-making history together. So it's fun. It's challenging for the family. It's fun for us to see what we can do to be helpful.
Well, of course, it leads to a question about how communities can do a better job of helping families report early signs of cognitive impairment, to become aware of these changes in a better way, a more effective way of embracing the inevitable. Like you say, thinking about adolescence before the children get to adolescence. How can that happen?
I don't know if we're ever going to get families to think carefully about the realities of aging ahead of some experiential process. I mean, when you're in the middle of it, you see things that you literally did not see when you're watching it in a friend's family, for example. I do think that some of what we can do, however, is that, first of all, we can get the service delivery systems to integrate families in as quickly as possible. So if you've ever had a family member, for example, land in a hospital in an emergency room, typically our healthcare system is not well structured to integrate families into the healthcare process. Families are seen as informants, perhaps, but kind of people to keep at a distance until you're ready for discharge. Well, I think we might want to think differently about that. If we really respect the fact that families do 80 to 90% of all of the healthcare for older adults, we might want to think about families as our core partners so that early on, when a problem's identified in any formal system, we start asking the question, who's in the family and how can we partner with them from the provider vantage point? that would help families get information sooner about what providers are seeing. Secondly, we can share with families assessment data. We can have data that shape the framework the family uses. So in our setting at the CU Aging Center, it's very common for us to have families come in describing in detail, quite accurately, what they're witnessing in day-to-day life that is worrying them and giving it the wrong name. So, for example, they may see an older adult who's sitting a lot, not engaging in life with much vivacity. And the family views that as depression and calls it depression and have tried all kinds of strategies to motivate that person unsuccessfully. So the family has the right observation but the wrong name, so it leads them to the wrong action. So what we notice is that if we ask families in great detail about what they're observing, they're really good informants. And then we need to get good assessment data to get the right name for the problem so that we and the family can partner around action steps that would address the underlying problem.
What might be the problem in that circumstance, just to take that analogy further, what could have been the problem that they were confronting that they didn't have the right name for?
Well, an example could be that the person might have changed medications recently. And so they actually are in what we think of as a delirium state that is affecting their cognition and their day-to-day function.
Very interesting.
They may also be in the early stages of a dementia because the behavior I described was loss of initiation skill. They're not initiating action. And it's not because they're not motivated, but it's because the cognitive pathways have been negatively affected by the dementia.
Very interesting. Okay, well, let's take a break for our sponsors very quickly here. And when we come back, I want to start talking about some of the, call it the business applications of what Dr. Sarah Qualls does at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. It's a very interesting story. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
Reflecting on our conversation just before we took the break, this hit me home quite a bit, Sarah, because of the fact that I was the primary caretaker for my parents. And at one point, my father was put on Dilantin and phenobarbital for one minor epileptic event, maybe in the, I'd say, the early 90s, or actually probably the mid-80s. And then when I eventually, years later, got him to Denver, where they're in their final year of caretaking, and took him to the University of Colorado's hospital, we discovered that, A, he was over-medicated, and B, he probably didn't need the medications. And that, of course, was a determination made by a gerontologist. So he ended up having a lot of sleepy days he didn't need to have over many years. And in retrospect, I very much regretted that he had not been assessed by a team of geriatric and gerontological specialists. Does that sound familiar?
It totally sounds familiar. I think that with advancing age, the complexity of managing chronic diseases that are underlying, that are affecting all of us, with acute problems that are at the surface, becomes more and more and more complex. And of course, we all know older adults who are on many, many medicines. And that makes you more at risk for all kinds of things.
Oh, absolutely. And that is a major point here that everybody needs to pay attention to, because I also found out my mother was being over-medicated as well. And both of them had well-meaning primary physicians, but they were not specialized in the area of gerontology and geriatrics. So enough said there. Let's talk about where the rubber hits the road a little bit. Palisades is a very fascinating residential retirement community in Colorado Springs, a absolutely beautiful facility, all new, just opened a few years ago. And part of the secret sauce, if you will, of Palisades is a collaboration with you and UCCS and your team. So I wondered if you could talk about it a little bit. Tell us a little bit about Palisades to begin with, who lives there and what services do they receive, and then what is the interaction with UCCS and Palisades?
Palisades at Broadmoor Park is a multi-level residential facility. It is lease-based, so it's not a continuum of care retirement community that someone needs to buy into. People can come in on a lease basis and leave as they wish. It has approximately 130 units. About a little under 50 of those are independent apartments and patio homes. About 45 or so are assisted living apartments, and then there is a memory care unit that is a secured unit of assisted living, essentially, services. The independent living residents include receive within their lease a meal a day equivalent. They don't have to take it every single day, but a meal a day equivalent, some light housekeeping, that sort of thing, but no personal health care services are included in independent living. What we do include at Palisades, which is distinctive because of our collaboration, is a wide array of wellness services, and I'll tell you about that in just a moment. Assisted living, as is the case across any facility, is the definition is regulated by the state, and assisted living includes support for the independent activities of daily living, including can include medication administration, might not, always includes three meals a day, housekeeping, and then added support services as needed. Memory care adds further services that help to manage the day-to-day challenges of behavioral manifestations of dementias and other kinds of brain diseases. In 2005, I was a speaker on a panel for the Chamber of Commerce, actually, after which the owner of Palisades invited me to join a conversation to consider collaborating. They had at that time purchased the land and were in the early stages of planning process. And as we began talking about it, we started to share our vision for where might the future of senior housing go and what really fundamentally needed to change in the industry in order to open possibilities for improved quality of life with an eye toward the future generations of older adults that were not going to be enamored with the way we've done senior housing in the past. So as we began that exploration, we formed a team from the university, which consists of a nurse practitioner, nursing faculty member, a health promotions faculty member, and a health scientist, and myself. And around that team now, other faculty have joined us from nutrition and psychology and other disciplines. But that core three-person team ended up visioning a strong, wellness-oriented senior housing environment, a context that would create a culture of well-being so that when people moved in, they had a chance to improve rather than decline, knowing that some people would come in and have serious health issues that would lead them toward decline. We organize that around sort of three core processes. One is we have an on-site primary care clinic that is nurse practitioner-centric, meaning that nurse practitioners who tend to have sort of a holistic view of health would be the service providers. We also have a very strong health and wellness program that resides in a wellness center that is the geographic and conceptual and sort of heart hub of the whole campus. So people interact with that center for wellness in the form of massage or in the form of gym or in the form of some kind of an assessment of their own physical well-being. The third component is the behavioral health and supporting a culture of engagement that really engaged people in being proactive around their physical health, their cognitive health, and their social health, along with other aspects, spiritual and disease management, etc. So that's the hub of the Palisades concept. The owners in this case took the risk of not only funding the services that the university staff and students and faculty would provide, but they were created this innovation fund, basically, at our community foundation fund here in town that supports research at this center. So faculty and students can apply for research funding to do a project that might pan out to provide positive benefit to the residents.
Okay.
I want to say one other thing, Brent, and that is that I think our core innovation is not only this sort of positive, proactive view, not naive, and I don't think, but a proactive view around health and wellness, but also a real intention to be providing services that are personalized at the level of the assessment of a person's functioning for what they really need. So in the Independent, for example, every year as a part of their lease, each resident has the privilege, not the requirement, but the privilege of going through a four-component assessment of their cognition, their physical well-being, strength, balance, mobility, range of motion, gait, their health with a nurse practitioner, and their psychosocial well-being. And the data from that is integrated and handed back to them saying, here's how we see your wellness strengths. Here's how we see your challenges. Here's what we heard you say was motivating you to take charge of your life. And here's some things you might want to pay attention to in that domain. And then we hand that back to them, and they are totally in charge of what they do next in the Independent side. In the Assisted side, that assessment then informs the care planning that is typically done collaboratively with the resident, the family, and the staff.
Well, it's a fascinating interaction between the university and Palisades at Broadmoor Park, and a lot of credit going to Jeff Dunn, the developer, and Toby Gannett, the executive director, who both were visionary. They don't come from your industry, but they embraced your industry. I had an opportunity to visit the facility with you, Sarah, and I was very impressed. I could only hope that I would be able to have that kind of personal evaluation of all factors related to my health as part of my living arrangement where I live now. The fitness facility, for example, is very state of the art. It's a credit card type of system where you put a card in and it determines who you are and what level you are on a given machine. Machine adjusts to where you were and then slightly pushes you forward to the next level. So it's a very scientifically developed fitness center. And of course it has all of the traditional facilities with rooms and so forth, but very well designed, like, for example, smaller dining rooms. So people don't go into a great big vast dining room and get lost and maybe start isolating themselves if they're not particularly social to begin with. So those were kind of some of my impressions looking at it, if you will, from a former caregiver perspective, as well as a boomer, as to, will I live here someday? So I was very impressed. And one of the things that your initiative has led to is actually the development of a software product called the Resident Care System, or RCS. So what is this? What does it do? And how can it assist assisted living facilities or CCRCs or whatever in the caregiving area?
One of the big challenges in any integrated care system of any kind is communication. So in traditional senior housing, whether we're talking about skilled nursing or assisted livings, one of the really big challenges is communication among a variety, the very wide variety of participants in that setting. So a housekeeper notices pills on the floor. Whom does she tell? And how is that information made useful or determined whether it is useful or not? A family member is taking someone to a specialty appointment in the community. How does that information flow back into the system? A transportation staff member notices that today Mrs. Jones really struggled to get up into the van, and he's never seen that before. Communication is at the heart of integration. We cannot integrate care without it. And it turns out that in assisted living, the standard has continued to be a paper-based communication system where we document a lot of what we observe. Unfortunately, in order to access all that good documentation, you have to proactively figure out where to go, what to inquire of, and where to spend your time reading. And the probability that you hit the really important piece is not high. Furthermore, lots of the players that I just mentioned, the transportation person or the housekeeper, would not write in any of that documentation. So we embraced early on the need for communication as a very core component of Palisades. And one piece of communication that we needed to help support was in the assisted living facility. So early on in the development of Palisades, a friend actually of the owners began the development of a software system, and through lots and lots of conversations would ask us, so who needs to know this and why, and who shouldn't know that, and what do you do about privacy, and how do you handle this, and who needs to know the staffing pattern, and the various questions that a software developer would ask. And so when the facility opened a few years ago, the university team got involved in the development of that software and now has helped contribute to it, although honestly Kent Carlson's the sort of genius behind it. Mm-hmm. So we are at a point now that Palisades in the fall went paperless. Now keep in mind that there were 6 separate paper-bound notebooks that were being maintained as part of the documentation system that is needed for operations and is required by state health department. So we've integrated that into a living push-pull software. So information is pushed out to someone on a need-to-know basis and protected with all kinds of firewalls when people don't need to know. So here's a good example. Your mother has been placed in an assisted living, let's say, and someone is going to bathe her tomorrow, whom she's never met. What could we possibly push forward to that bathing staff person that would help that interaction between the staff and your mother be as appropriate, personal, and professional as possible? So in the case of the RCS, for example, we feed forward a screen, a tablet or a PC or a laptop, that shows the staff member your mother's picture, describes her bathing preferences, what's really important to her about a bath, everything from time of day to temperature to how she wants the room set up, and then also describes some talking points, things that your mother really likes to talk about, which could become very important for the staff member if your mom needs to be distracted from a difficult moment. Or just a way of building rapport, just the tools the staff member needs to build rapport with your mother. And then also fed forward is information from the last few shifts. What did others record in their interaction from your mother that would have normally been embedded deep in a book? Now it's right there for the staff member to see. Oh, on the last shift, she was really agitated, but yesterday during the day, she was fine. The staff member then has information on a need-to-know basis in a timely way to shape his or her interaction to be more personal and appropriate with the given resident. That information, of course, can be and is tracked by the staff. Notifications can be sent from the staff to the management, and the managers can really track who's interacting effectively with residents A, B, and C, but less effectively with G, H, and I, and so that the management structure can respond to personnel issues, concerns, and possibilities, partnering with the staff to provide good care, and the management is in a really good position to be able to report to families. Your mother, the typical scenario where the family member is being told by a resident, you know, I haven't gone to any activities for the last week, nobody's talking to me. And they may be saying that because they have serious memory impairment. The manager can look at the record and very quickly ascertain that this resident had actually been invited to 20 activities in the last 2 days and had declined in 18 of them, went to 2, was reported to be highly engaged, and they actually have a photo of her doing X that appears to show positive affect. That's very meaningful to the family.
Wow. Well, you know, this is fascinating, and I obviously can see the power of digitizing record keeping, because once it's digitized, it's accessible and organizable. And as you say, it's, you can disseminate it to people in a much more efficient manner. And obviously, it's clear from what you described as to how that could serve the well-being and the comfort and the acceptance of the individual receiving the care. So when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about Palisades. And I'd like to talk about the field of geropsychology. This is something that is interesting to me, since that was my graduate study was in the area of psychology. And I think it's a burgeoning field, and it'll be fun to learn a lot more. So we'll be right back.
Be sure to join us at fmguniversity.com. That's where we can turn your passion into business within 30 days, put some fun back into your life, show you how to make money, and do good for yourself and others. That's why we are called FMG, Fun Money Good. Get started today. Go to fmguniversity.com.
So in discussing Palisades and the unique software product that Sarah Qualls has developed with others, the RCS system, you can see that they're bringing to bear very cutting-edge thinking about how do you improve the care experience for the person receiving the care as well as the family. And all of that somewhat dovetails with the primary discipline that she brings to this project as well as many others, and that is the discipline of geropsychology. So for those of us who are not absolutely familiar with what that means, what is geropsychology? And how is it connected with mental health care of older adults?
Geropsychology is honestly simply the term that we use within the field of psychology to discuss the specialty. So people who want to develop advanced skills in serving older adults would be geropsychologists in a parallel way that in the medical field they become geriatricians. So in geropsychology, we are interested in building competency in psychologists to know about the biological, the psychological, and the social contexts of normal aging, as well as abnormal aging difficulties. So we train students to know about normal adult development and aging, and we train them to know about various kinds of abnormalities that arise. We also train them to understand the settings and contexts of aging. Policy context, social context, because those become the arenas in which we either work primarily or in which we guide our clients to change behavior patterns. So if I've got someone who's depressed and I want to help them engage in more activity, I really need to understand the social structure or the social fabric of a community and its older adult population.
One of the questions that I have about this is that what is unique to the aging process that impinges on our psychological health? What are some of the major problems that people who are not following a normal course in their cognitive aging might exhibit?
Probably cognitive aging is one of the unique areas of psychopathology within older adults that's distinct from younger adults. In younger adults, you really only get cognitive problems if you have a significant disease like a neurological disease, maybe multiple sclerosis that advances, or a traumatic brain injury, which we certainly are seeing plenty of coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. Aging, however, the brain brings with it a vulnerability in the brain to disease processes that we huddle under an umbrella called dementias, as well as more acute processes that are caused by vascular incidents like a stroke, a bleed, or a blockage of the vascular system that produces an acute problem typically with long-term consequences. So it is certainly the case that older adults have the same kinds of psychopathology that younger adults have, whether it's depression or anxiety problems or post-traumatic stress disorder. We know they have actually a slightly lower prevalence than younger adults of all of those problems. And we know that there is a pretty high rate of the presence of symptoms of depression and anxiety in older adults who don't quite meet threshold for diagnosis, but they're struggling with it. So our fancy term is subsyndromal. They're just below the syndrome level, but there's a problem there. So social isolation, physical health decline, especially cardiovascular decline, will affect the brain and affect cognition, and then cognitive problems due to dementias. And those typically show up early on as difficulties with everyday life activities, especially the complicated activities. So families will see a person who's always been able to put a fancy meal on the table fluidly, struggling to get all the pieces parts to come together. Or they witness difficulties in managing complicated financial arrangements or complicated medical regimens. So we first see it in the loss of skill and complexity if it's a dementia-based problem. We will see it in much more focal areas if it's a stroke, because strokes hit a particular part of the brain, and whatever that part's responsible for will be what is affected.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. Given that, obviously, depression is a major challenge with older adults, I'm going to ask kind of a silly question here, but it's still pertinent to me. Why wouldn't people be appropriately depressed with so many losses in old age? You know, plus, we do live in a society that's quite unkind to its aging. Why wouldn't depression be a normal coping response to otherwise very difficult situations in our life that nobody can kid are difficult?
That's really actually a fascinating question, because if you understand that older adults have actually a slightly lower prevalence of depression, then you have to ask the question, how come not? How come they're all depressed? And so it sort of focuses you then on resilience and on compensatory processes. So what our field has learned is that, in fact, there are gains and losses all across the lifespan. And in fact, the balance tips a little more heavily toward losses in later life. Yet the same compensatory processes we used in young adulthood to cope with the loss of parental support as we embrace the gain of independence, we use those same kinds of compensatory processes in later life. So, for example, here's a good example. Almost every older adult will talk about having less energy than they had when they were younger. Well, there's a loss. The compensatory process that people put in place, it's actually, there are many processes people put in place, but let's imagine that I recognize that I can only choose one outside event a day that I can do because I have limited energy. My selection of that event will ensure that I do something that is very important to me. And from that, I get the same psychological feeding of my soul that I used to get from five events. What we've really learned is that older adults are very adaptive. And in fact, there are lots of reasons to pay attention to their adaptive resilient processes, at least as much as to their challenges.
Okay, let me ask this question another way. Since you have just written a book on caregiver family therapy, what is the role of depression in the caregiver setting, and how does it play in the care of the oldest old?
We know that caregiving, especially ongoing caregiving, puts people at risk for a lot of problems. Depression is one of them. The rates of clinical depression in caregivers are estimated to be somewhere around 30%. That's probably a little bit high of a number, but let's say 20 to 30% as a really solid workable number. Well, that's very meaningful because, of course, depression also puts you at risk for other kinds of health problems and anxiety and poor sleep. So there's a depletion problem going on when people provide care over time that our society must step forward and help with. And so services are available now in many communities, usually accessed through the Area Agency on Aging, which can direct people to the kind of resources that are available locally. sometimes people find that they need respite care. Maybe it's, I need a 2-hour break in my home for you to care for my loved one so I can go to the grocery store, or so I can go to the gym, or so I can go get a massage, something that nurtures me. Counseling and respite are two of the big ones that happen and are really, really important. There are day programs. And often, caregivers really struggle with making decisions about when it's time to add more services or time to maybe do a residential placement, even though they didn't want to, when it's time to take away the car keys. Those are very weighty decisions that exhaust the caregiver.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a final break here. And when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about your views of the future of aging from both your post in an academic setting at the University of Colorado Springs, as well as somebody who is very involved in the practical application of this knowledge to the residential care setting. What is the future going to bring us with this very rapidly aging of the boomer generation? We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
Clearly, the media talk a lot about and write a lot about the boomers aging and how many people will be going past the age of 65 today, which, by the way, is 10,000, and will continue for about the next 18, 19 years. So anyway, what are the implications of the aging populations from your perspective?
The aging of the boomer population, of course, right now is focused on what we call late midlife, young old. Some people call it the third age. That time when in late 60s, mid 60s, late 60s, early 70s, when people generally have pretty robust health, have more time available because they've launched children and often have retired. And what a new colleague of mine, Peter Engstrom, calls refirement, the need to create a life structure that centers around refiring them to be engaged. So today, what we need to worry about in our communities is providing pathways for the baby boomers to stay connected in their world and give back to society, give back to communities. They have much to give, they want to work, and they need the opportunity to do either paid or unpaid work, but primarily to engage. What's coming, however, is a period when we know that baby boomers will also develop chronic and acute diseases that make them more frail. So in 15 years, what we're going to need to be worrying about is a much better integrated network of services for frailer older adults. As you know, Brent, this group of baby boomers has always demanded things on their own terms. We have always wanted the world to be relatively easy for us to navigate. We've wanted to have our preferences met. And I think that's going to happen as we age. So the current fragmented, siloed service delivery system is not going to be acceptable. We're going to want to be able to have a lot of choice, and we're going to want to be able to have our care needs well integrated to meet our needs according to our preferences.
Well, clearly, you're anticipating that. All one has to do is take a look at Palisades as an example of where the care has been integrated. The communication has been simplified so that the individual experiences less challenge with the actual care delivery system. So I fully embrace not only what you just said, but about the boomers and their needs to really customize the arrangements around their lives according to their own needs and values. but also the ability to deliver that, which is demonstrated by Palisades. And by the way, to the listeners, I would just have you Google Palisades at Broadmoor Park if you want to see more about that particular facility. One of the questions, and it's really going to have to be my last question today because this has been such a fascinating conversation. I hate to see it come to an end, but this is kind of a boomer type of question. Do you anticipate boomers aging cognitively any different from today's oldest old? Or what they're going to go through is pretty much developmental changes that are universally applied to every generation. Will we age differently beyond just how we do it culturally and socially, but in our brains? Do you think things will be different?
It's a golden question. And the reason it's golden is that we don't know all the factors that are driving cognitive aging, normal and disease-based aging. What we do know is that the one fact that I think there's no disagreement on is that cardiovascular health drives brain health. And what we do know is that the boomer generation is not any cardiovascularly healthier than the previous generations. Mm-hmm. So we have every reason to be just as concerned.
Okay. I'm also wondering, for example, something like if you take a look at boomers, generally they're computer literate because computers hit their desks in the 80s, right at the beginning of the computer revolution. And a lot of the tools that are being applied to today's oldest old, such as Jack York's It's Never Too Late, he's been on my radio show, are trying to help people go through that hurdle of interacting with computer interfaces, and boomers can do that. Now, that doesn't change cognitive decline due to cardiovascular disease, but it might change the way people absorb and relate to the technologies that might interact with us 20 years from now. Is that a fair speculation, for example?
I think it is. We know that we need to stay cognitively engaged, and we know that boomers are comfortable using the computer, so that will be a great tool for us to build from in terms of cognitive engagement opportunities. It's also going to be computerized tools are going to become very powerful in helping us manage our health on our own at home. And we've already got pieces of that popping up all over the place for people with high and low cognitive function.
Well, that is interesting and worthy of speculation. And you just touched on another point that boomers are saying, and they're probably going to take action around doing as much possible to age in place in the home. And of course, we've talked about industries that are developing very quickly. For example, Care Innovations, which is a collaboration between GE and Intel, as an example. And so are you anticipating that your software system, the RCS, might eventually have home-based applications as well to accommodate this possibility, I put that in quotes, of a lot more boomers refusing to go to facilities or residential care communities and choose instead to stay at home?
I think that the technologies we're developing now in various innovation centers like Palisades are going to have applications all across the community. And I think that the prototypes that we're developing today in one setting are going to have to shift, of course, and be modified to apply to other settings. But the problems they're designed to solve are core problems across all settings.
Great.
So community integrated care is the future, whether it's from home-based to facility-based. We have to find the support mechanisms for communication, detection of difficulties, and prompting and encouraging the behaviors that people need to engage in to be healthy.
Well, on that note, I am sorry to say we have to come to a conclusion in our conversation. I could definitely continue this conversation for much longer. I really appreciate your taking the time today, Sarah, to join the show and tell us about your work at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, as well as your work with Palisades. It's been a really fascinating and eye-opening discussion.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm delighted to talk about it because I believe we need to give it away and encourage as many other people to engage in innovative processes as we can.
Right. Hear, hear. Well, it's going to be exciting to watch your academic work become widely known and applied in other communities and residential care facilities. So if you, our listeners, want to find out more about Dr. Sarah Qualls, Q-U-A-L-L-S, I would suggest just Googling her name, and you'll find many different landing places on the internet where she will appear. And I want to thank you for joining the show. So if you have questions or comments, you can post them on my Facebook page. That's facebook.com/generationreinvention. Or you can follow me and send direct messages on Twitter. I tweet at Boomer Marketing. And then, of course, there's my blog. And it's going to begin its seventh year in about a month, presenting a continuing conversation about the boomer future. And that's at boomers.typepad.com. So as always, please tell your friends, colleagues, and clients about a worldwide boomer revolution discussed here weekly, and we call it, of course, Generation Reinvention.
You've been listening to Generation Reinvention with your host, Brent Green. Visit Brent at his website at generationreinvention.com, and for archive shows, be sure to visit his show page here on the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is, have fun,